This is Kelly Lally, and I'm here in Bowling Green, Kentucky with Mr. O.L. Thomas. It's June the 8th, 1987, and I'm here today to talk to Mr. Thomas about his work with the CCC at Mammoth Cave. I guess the first thing I should ask you is a little bit about your family background. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up here in Warren County. Actually, I was born in Missouri, but that's too long a story. It'd take your whole tape.
So your family, as far as you remember it, always lived in Bowling Green?
Well, of course, I know all my ancestors but and the relatives other places, but my father, yes, that's all there is to it here, see. He was the only one of my tribe here. Okay. Because he came here when they had that first oil boom. From Missouri.
Okay. What were times like for you and your family during the Depression?
Well, they were rough. I'm sure you've already heard about it. There's not, I doubt, much that I can add. Might interest you to know that I traveled 11 mile round trip to high school and back every day, besides milking 6 cows before I went and after I got back. And that I worked on farms for people for 50 cents a day on my lunch. Now I know that some people hear that and they'll say, well, that sounds bad, but then I doubt it. But you can go out here and ask most of these old timers and you'll find out that that's the way that it was. Well, I wouldn't have volunteered that if you hadn't have asked it. But and that's what, when we got out of high school, most of us fellows that were in those camps, a great deal of them were just out of high school with nothing to do. And we also even had some people that was in colleges that had to drop out. Like, for instance, I got a couple of pictures here of two fellows that were studying forestry at the University of Ohio who were down there, and they also worked for me as fire dispatchers at Mammoth Cave National Park. But it was a rough time of depression. But I would say this, we weren't in need at any time because we owned a little piece of land and raised most of everything that we needed. $5 would buy a month's supply of groceries, believe it or not, in those days. Of course, you didn't have to buy much but sugar, salt. That was about the total. Flour, you had to buy a little flour. You didn't have to buy a meal because we had that ground ourselves.
And so your family basically farmed for a living?
No, my father was always in the machinery business. He was in the oil business. But after he got killed, my father got killed in 1928 when I was 12. And I was the head of a household beginning about the age of 12. That left me and my mother at home. Would you believe that we bought that old farm we lived on for $450? $50 down and $50 a year at 6%. I went to high school and worked on farms and paid for it. You better get back to your CCC days or you won't have any tape left.
Well, how did you hear about the CCC?
Well, I had a partner or a friend who graduated the same day from high school I did, whose mother was worked for the employment agency. Even way back in those days they had that. And so she submitted my name to them, and you had to do a little qualifying back in those days even for that thing. If you had any kind of a record or anything in your background, that was a little derogatory. You didn't get into that. Thank goodness. That's why I was giving you a comparison about this other organization. They don't have anything but, in my opinion, riffraff in it. Now, we were anything in the world but riffraff. I'm pretty cranky about it because a lot of people think that that thing and the CCs is the same thing. They're hardly related.
So people in the area had to go through an employment agency to get in the CCC?
Well, they still have that, you know. But back during those days, there was practically no jobs even at the employment agency. But Mr. Roosevelt initiated this thing to employ young men who were trying to go to school and getting out of school to give them something to do. And believe me, it was a fine, fine project, and they did great, great work.
So how were people selected in this area, or did anybody?
Well, you applied, but if you had a bad reputation, they didn't, or if it was known, of course, we had some bad apples, a few of them, not too many.
Did you know anybody who wasn't accepted for the CCC?
I don't remember anyone myself, because they didn't go around advertising who got rejected. Okay. But I'm sure there were some. I know there was some that got kicked out shortly after they got there, too. You see, they were controlled by the Army Reserve. You may not have been posted on that yet. But in this picture here, you will note that the Army, we didn't have what you'd call military training, but we had a considerable amount of military discipline. See here in the front center, the two Army officers, Turner and Calvert, Captain Turner and Lieutenant Calvert, and they kept a pretty tight string. And you didn't go wandering around all over the world. You had a certain amount of discipline. You had to keep that area spotless, as you can well see here.
So the military influence was...
That's right.
Was big.
And we lived under military conditions. Those barracks were spotless. They were kept that way, and they better stay that way, or you got yourself a whole bunch of KP if you were an enrollee, and a whole bunch of other punishment, which was all right with me.
Now, when did you say you entered the CCC right after high school?
Got out. I graduated from high school. No, I had to lay out a year, and so I was 19. I graduated from high school May 17th, 1935. And I enrolled in that thing on July 8th, 1935.
And how long were you in the CCC?
I was there 26 months.
Which camp were you in?
Number 3, Company 582.
Okay. I don't know if my voice is picking up very well here. Describe how you felt when you left home for the CCC.
Well, I felt great, frankly, because we needed the money, and $30 was a whole lot more than you was going to make someplace else. Besides, I was full of ambition. I had confidence, because when you live the kind of life I had and overcome my obstacles, you had to have confidence. And I didn't figure I was always going to be a CCC man. Which you'll soon find out.
So you didn't really get homesick or anything?
Oh, no. I was just short distance
That's
from
right.
home. However, I was a little disappointed when they unloaded me at Mammoth Cave. I thought perhaps I might get to go west. I had always wanted to go. But fate says you stay here, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
What kind of training did you have before you started your work in the CCC?
Well, I don't know what they do in high school nowadays, but... I had mechanical drawing and drafting when I was in the 7th and 8th grade and the first 2 years of high school. I have all my drawings out there yet. And if I do say so, I was pretty sharp on mathematics and awful good in science.
Did they have a particular training period for you for all of the...
Oh, when we first went in, we took a bunch of shots like you do when you're going into the military. And we had what we called a 2-week, I suppose you might call it a training period. They didn't any of us much need any training physically. So we were tough as pine knots. Practically all of them was country boys anyway. Oh, we had a few from the big cities up north, but not too many. So we didn't have any physical worries or anything of that sort. But for the first 2 weeks while you were there, after taking those shots, they didn't let you go out and do too tough of stuff, except we hiked around here and there and the other thing, and we built some... horseshoe courts and volleyball courts and repaired this and that and the other thing, whatever needed done for the first 2 weeks, and then we were assigned.
So you're training whatever the 2 weeks was at Mammoth Cave, because I had heard that some went to Fort Knox.
Well, of course, they had a camp at Fort Knox.
Uh-huh.
See, we had a regular curriculum there, sports and also studies. For instance, we played basketball. There was eight camps that was in an organization, a league. We had baseball. We had track and field meets. Might interest you to know that I never lost a 100-yard, 50-yard, or 220-yard dash. Look at that.
Ooh. I used to be a sprinter myself.
I always won all three of the events, 100, 50, and the 220. I also... made every all-star team they had on baseball. It just happens that there is a horrible picture that was made in 1936.
You catching a baseball.
Well, I had it in my hand.
Oh, it looks like you catching a baseball. Well, so they had a lot of organized
sports. That's right.
And recreation.
Sure don't look like it now, do it?
Well, can you describe your very first day in camp? Do you remember it?
No, but I can tell you what I can remember. I can remember the third day in camp.
Please do.
Well, you see, this number three camp had the champion baseball team. And, of course, every time they got in rookies, they called it rookies just like they did in the military. Why, they called for volunteers or people who thought they could make the baseball team. Well, I thought I could make the baseball team. You see that crooked finger?
Oh.
I got that July the 10th. A fellow by the name of Crenshaw, who died just recently, was a fastball pitcher from way back. And so I went over and they got up a team of the scrubs, they called us. You know, we were just rookies to play their team. And Crenshaw was the pitcher. Well, I just happened to get that finger in the catcher's mitt. I also could catch as well as play short and third and all the other places. And tore the end of that finger completely in two, just about. And you know, you talk about fits for about 3 days. That thing, whoo, there wasn't anything they could do to stop that thing from hurting. Oh, it was that big round and purple. I remember that day very well. But I made the team. So as soon as my finger got well.
So you say you were paid $30 a month.
When you enrolled, you would pay $30 a month and your board and clothes.
And did part of that money go to your family?
All of it but $5.
How did you spend your personal money?
Well, $5 didn't go very far, but I smoked, and so I bought cigarettes for one thing. And once in a while, I'd get a day or two off and light out to Bowling Green. It cost 35 cents for bus fare, although I walked all the way from Mammoth Cave to Bowling Green a couple of times when I wanted to come home on weekends. Later on, I was not off on weekends. I was off on Mondays and Tuesdays because I had to, after I got that fire dispatcher's job, I was employed. I had to pull weekend duty all the time.
Where did you do your shopping?
Well, you didn't do much shopping. They had a thing called a recreation hall. And in the recreation hall, which is this little building right here, they had a PX, like in the military.
Commissary type thing?
Sort of a commissary type thing.
Did you ever go into any of the local towns?
I seldom went to Cave City. That was the only place near. Well, sometimes we'd go to a show down there, but I wasn't too crazy about shows. There were too many other things I liked to do. Ooh, that burned me.
Now I want to talk a little bit about the work projects. You were talking about being a fire dispatcher. Did you have any other special roles in the CCC camp, or could you describe that one, the different things that you did?
Well, I suspect I'd better talk about the assignments of the many that were there. When they bring in rookies, why, of course, they had some knowledge of you. And sometimes they would assign you to this, that, and the other thing. But most of the men that went there were sent in the field. That was called field work. And most of them were engaged in cutting down dead trees, making fire trails, soil erosion work, and such as that. Some few of them were assigned to the quarries. Didn't anybody want in those quarries, but nonetheless, some of them had to get assigned to the quarries. And that was real tough work. I'm glad I didn't get assigned there. Matter of fact, I never did get assigned anywhere. A man by the name of E. Scott Robinson was the educational instructor there at that camp. And I don't remember exactly how he found out that I was, like I said earlier, pretty good at mathematics and science and had drafting. And they were looking for someone for various specialized jobs. And they gave a little test up there one day, and it had to do with algebra, progressions, and I can't remember that other word or two. See, in high school you had some things back in those days I'm not sure they teach now in high school. And of course they found out by looking at some of the things I filled out with that drafting lettering that I could do drafting. So they gave me this test, and I passed it, and so they sent me over to the central office as fire dispatcher. That, of course, carried an increase in pay to $45 a month.
And how much did you get to keep?
Oh, got to keep 20 of that.
Ah.
But then I made money besides that. Like I told you, I'm a busy fellow. I had grand ideas one time when I was still in high school. course, I'm glad that it didn't work out that way, of being an artist and a sign painter. I used to go down here to Stockyards when I was in high school, and I would take my cans of paint and paint farmers' names and the name of their farm on the side of their truck of a nickel a letter. Shoot, I'd make myself $8 and $10 a day a few times right in the middle of that depression down there at that Stockyard painting names. And then after I got in camp up there, of course, all these guys had to have footlockers, and I painted these eagles and their names, Company 582, Mammoth Cave National Park. I got $1 a whack for doing that. And a lot of weekends, that's all I did was paint names and pictures on top of footlockers and so forth and so on. Well, I had to do things. I couldn't be. And then we got Ray Scott, whose name you have on that list, was a number two camp, and he was assigned as a photographer. And we worked together. We'll get to that in a minute. But Ray and I, he also was, for some reason, was a sign painter. And then we got jobs painting signs on churches and motels and so forth and so on up there in that area. Ray Scott and I stayed awful busy. We had a heap of things to do. We didn't have time to be running around.
So, people were assigned.
Well, when they first arrived there, after their 2 weeks, well, they were usually assigned to some job. That don't mean that they always had to stay on it. If they showed us some ability for something else, why, they would probably get something else to do.
And so you worked with the fire dispatcher, is that?
Almost immediately after I got up there, I was assigned to a fire dispatcher's job.
What did you do?
Well, I'll tell you, at that time, they don't have many fires there now, but at that time, you see, that was a project. And you got to understand those people that lived up there. You see, I don't know whether you've ever seen any of those movies about the Tennessee Valley, when they was building those dams and how they fought against the government and gave people an awful lot of hard times about condemning their land. See, that was their ancestral homes, and they didn't want to give it up. That's why I hauled Ray Scott's around, because he was taking the worst picture he could find. See, he didn't have a vehicle assigned to his business, and we had two at the fire dispatcher's office. So when it wasn't a bad fire season, I would haul Ray around while he would take pictures. We'd been chased off many a time with a double-barrel shotgun a few times. But my chief job was, first I made the original maps that were put on top of those lookout towers. They had to be set exactly north and south with a stringer coming up through the middle so you could take a sight with an azimuth across there where that smoke was coming up. Then where two lines intersected, that's where the fire was. I made those maps. I made the original fire atlas, which I think they're looking for up there yet. They've got another one, but that's not the one I want. I want the one that's got all that other stuff on it, those original fires. But those people set a lot of fires deliberately. And of course, there was an awful lot of sage grass. There was an awful lot of underbrush, and they would have terrible fires. I've had as many as 400 men fighting one fire right back behind where the Mammoth Cave offices are right now. That was called Mammoth Cave Hollow. The summer of 1936, we had just about everything we could get our hands on up there fighting fire down in there to keep it from burning up all the young trees and so forth and so on. But I think I dispatched in that approximate 2 years that I worked over at the central office, I think there was 368 fires. And we had to get the detail on the way in a hurry. And I would call the ferryman and have him to meet. We had one camp north of the river, but many times there wasn't enough men in that to put a fire out. And I would have the ferry meet the trucks coming across, because you had 15 minutes to get them started on their way. I think my average report time was something like 8. When it wasn't fire season, when it was wet, of course, there's very few roads up there now, but it was honeycombed with roads, and I had to know every one of those roads, the name of it, where it was going, and the whole detail. I had to have a razor-sharp memory, which I don't have anymore. But when that intersection, where those two lines crossed, that's where the fire was, and I had to get a detail there in a hurry. The quicker we got it there, the less fire we had. The further away it was, the bigger fire we had. And a lot of people sell them deliberately. I could tell you some good stories. We may get to it, but I doubt it.
Well, go ahead if you like.
No, we'll save that for a little later.
Okay, I have a card on that. Did you do anything else besides the fire dispatch? And
that was a full-time job.
No, I
also had 5 assistants.
Okay.
Which I hired myself. I selected them. In other words, once I got that job, well, Ellsworth, who was forester, and he stayed at the Great Smoky Mountains National Park most of the time, and left me, believe it or not, at the ripe old age of 19, that's Ellsworth, who was the forester in charge of Mammoth Cave National Park, and he also had the Great Smokies, and he stayed down there all the time, and after he found out I was competent, I ran Mammoth Cave National Park at the ripe old age of 19. I could have drafted the President of the United States if I'd have needed him within a time of fire. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Well, it was that way then. I don't know whether it is now or not. This is a picture of a part of him. That fellow, I can't remember his name offhand, but he was from up in Ohio. And this boy, his name is Kidd, and this name is Begley. Now, these two fellows were in forestry school at the University of Ohio and came down there to work during the summer. This is Uni Skipworth, the honest dog that ever lived. And this is O.L. Thomas right here. And these were the fellows that I got to help me in the dispatcher's office. There's two more that are not shown in this picture, but they weren't working there at the time. We had to increase our overhead some. A boy by the name of, last name's an officer, Frank, and Paul Nunn. Now, Nunn had also had some drafting experience in high school, as had this fella here. So they assisted me. Oh, we made all kinds of maps, Lord, property maps. In those condemnation suits, we did practically all of that work. We made the drawings, and there was just a lot to it.
So you also worked with drawing out the maps to the buildings that were still standing in the area? Is that?
The land areas around the buildings, practically all of it was farm area. We had to check those surveys because, you see, those were condemnation suits. And they had to establish the exact location and the exact boundaries and the exact acreage and so forth and so on to reach price for the land, see. Even though the government was paying more than the land was worth, those people still didn't want to go. And you can understand that. I could, at least. There it was old ancestral homes. As a matter of fact, sometimes when I wasn't working, be wet weather or snow on the ground, I would go to these old houses and climb up in the attics and the lofts after people were gone. Somewhere up there, they have all this stuff stashed. I'm talking about old land grants from the very beginning, old land charters, old wills, old deeds, probably a lot of old pictures. I can't remember all the stuff that I did collect out of those old attics and so forth and turn. Somewhere up there, I think they still have all that stuff stashed. Someday they may be able to get it out and into a museum. They're trying to get a museum of somewhat going. Have you been up there?
Yes.
Do they have anything going in the museum at all yet?
They're still working on it.
He told me that he didn't know whether they still had all that stuff. It's a shame if they don't have it, because it was really interesting stuff. And I would take all of that stuff and turn it into them. I also dug up all kind of Indian relics. I got, one time I had a man let me, you wouldn't know what a rock house is, but that's one of those bluffs back under, that's what they used to call them. I had a man let me down 300 feet down the side of one of those things on a rope so I could dig under it. That old boy, Uni Skipworth, I don't know whether I'd trust him to do that again or not, by golly.
So how many years were you in the CCC?
Well, just a little over 2 years.
2 years?
26 months, actually.
Okay.
Let's see, I think I have something here. Oh, that's not the one I'm looking for. Oh, well, I don't know where it is. I have a letter here that was written. Here it is. I decided to cast my lot someplace else.
This is to certify that Mr. Orale Thomas has been an assistant in my office since October 1935, and it is his interest. It's a recommendation. And who's this from?
Signed by Evans Ellsworth, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Turner?
Yeah, I can't.
Or is it just signed by Turner over to? Let's see. Evans Ellsworth, see the end of WRTH.
Yes.
Because he was my immediate supervisor, the forester. But I had decided, I got married on June the 19th, 1937, and I thought, well, best thing for me to do is to get me something else to do, and I was offered a job, and you could go over the hill, but I didn't choose to do that.
No.
I would rather have this little diploma here, wherever it is. I like to be legitimate. Somewhere in here, there is a certificate of discharge.
Uh-huh.
Is that mine or somebody else's?
That's yours. So
David H. Pritchett was the superintendent of what they call the ECW, Emergency Conservation Work, and Roy G. Turner was captain commanding.
Yeah,
so I didn't want to go over hills.
No.
I didn't want to be a deserter. I wanted everything to be legal. I'm a damn crank.
So was your wife from this area?
Oh yeah, she was always around here.
Well, back to when you first got into the CCC, could you describe a typical day of work for you?
Well, a typical day of work for me was not a typical day in the Civilian Conservation Corps, because I was on my own after I got this job. I was the, as I earlier said, you might not expect that a man 19 was doing that, but I had complete charge of the firefighting, everything in it. Also, I also had some 6 or 7 employees under me whose I had to make a schedule for them to work by. They all had to have days off, and I had to make schedules where I had someone at the fire stations. That was a job. We'll get into that in a minute. Of course, all of them were not in number 3 camp. All of the fire dispatchers were in number 3 camp. But I had some sweet time to keep and walking patrols on the job and some of the lookout patrols on the job. We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay. How many?
But I didn't have a typical day because my day was what needed done, and I was my own supervisor, and that's the way I like it.
How many fire stations were there in the park area?
If I recall correctly, there were at least 8. Each of the camps had a, I don't know whether you can see it from this picture or not, but each of the camps had a water tower. And each of the water towers had a, I don't believe you can see it from here, but this picture is made from the top of the water tower. It was out here, and on top of each water tower, there was a lookout station. And then we had at least 4 or 5. Let's see, they had one called Brooks Knob, which was down towards Brownsville. And there was one over in the northern area of the park called White Oak. And there was one over on the north side of the river called Hickory Cabin. And I can't remember the name of the others just offhand. That's 7 of names. But anyway, they had at least 8. And they were scattered at strategic points on high places, of course. White Oak, yes, that's another one of them. It was over on the north side, too. I mentioned White Oak, didn't I? I remember the boys' names that ran that one. One of them name was Reynolds. Well, both of them name was Reynolds. They were brothers. They were both number 2 camp. I didn't have any trouble with the Reynolds boys. But I had trouble with Double Ugly Anderson. Everybody had a nickname, by the way. He wasn't ugly at all. He was plumb handsome.
How did they get these nicknames?
Oh, I don't know. I was Kid Beef.
Kid Beef?
Yes, I was Kid Beef.
And you don't know how you got that?
Hell yes, I know how I got it, because I was also a champion boxer, and I beat their faces, and it looked like beef. Yes, I was. But anyway, Double Ugly was anything but Double. Oh, yeah, they had boxing matches and all that stuff. And I didn't even get to fight in my weight, Lord. I had to fight the heavyweight. Yeah, I did. But anyway, Double Ugly was number 3 camp, and his assignment was on top of number 3 lookout tower. Every time I'd have a fire that I thought I needed to get an azimuth from number 3 camp, I'd have to send out number 3 barracks and get him up on top of the tower. He's laid down and slept all the time. That's an honest rascal. Then we had several walking patrols. That was some of the, see, they had a telephone, portable telephone they carried with them. And there was a telephone line ran down this area that they had to walk. They stick a plug in the ground and throw a thing over the wire, and they could call me
if there was a fire.
And like they were supposed to each patrol, like O Depot. Well, I better not say that. O Depot.
It's okay.
The colored camp, and he had to report in on the hour all the time. I can hear him now. This O Depot reporting on the hour. But each.
This is side 2 of the first tape of my interview with O.L. Thomas. Yep, they're both supposed to go down.
Now back to those walking patrols. Yes. I'd have to get in that old pickup truck. They wouldn't report in, and I'd catch them in one of those old houses asleep somewhere. I'd have to do that but about twice, and we had a new walking patrol, too. But they all wanted on fire patrol. That wasn't near as hard to work
as the quarry.
As those quarries and that working in that hot woods. Oh, Lord, those guys that come in at night, they wouldn't be a dry thread on them anywhere. Lord have mercy.
How long of days did most of
them work? Just put in 8-hour days. But, kid, let me tell you something. Those were some kind of 8-hour days. Back in those days, they didn't have chainsaws. More, they pulled them old two-hand cross-cut saws, cutting those trees down and chopping them up and piling them in gullies and making fire trails and so forth. I didn't want any part of that. I had enough of that when I was a pup, you know, working on the farm sawing wood. I know about that.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about camp life now. How much free time did you have?
Well, of course, everybody was supposed to work about 8 hours a day. Actually, 8 hours didn't mean anything to the fire dispatchers. We might be working 24 hours sometimes. Again, you see, I was my own boss in that, and I did what had to be done. Now, the average, the regular fella, you know, that was assigned to details, they had an 8-hour day, 5 days a week. And then usually on Saturday morning, they had barracks inspection. And boy, everything better be spick and span, too, just like it was in the Air Force. I also flew B-25s in World War II. And I went through the pilot training when it still had the class system and the White Glove Act and all that good stuff. But anyway, you had regimentation, and we stood retreat about 3 times a week. You know what that is, where you lower the flag, and sometimes you'd have to go out for reveille when they raised the flag. We had a little military training, not greatly. But they had a pretty tough day. They earned their buck, I can tell you that, kid. Every bunch did. But most of them were happy. We had to have a very little dissension. Now and then you'd have a little rucus or something or other, but not often. And we had had a few bad apples, but they didn't last long. They'd usually say, "We don't need you anymore," and send them home.
So, besides painting signs and eagles for people, what did you do with most of your free time? I guess sports.
Well, that's right. We had to usually play a double header on Fridays and Saturdays. I didn't have too much spare time, personally. But it was spare time to me because, after all, I wanted to play on the teams and so forth, take part in the track meets. As far as I was concerned, that was spare time. That was play. But the whole job I had was play.
You had a good time at all of it.
I did. I thoroughly enjoyed the whole thing. This is Miss Lally. That's Annie. You missed half of the damn sermon.
Yeah, well, we're talking about the CCC. So, did you... Aside from taking that test at the beginning of the year, did you participate in any of the education programs?
Yeah, I as a matter of fact, also held a job as assistant educational advisor at the camp for some little period of time. Then I finally, E. Scott Robinson, Mr. Robinson I'll call him, I told him about another fellow that had about half sense like I did, and so he gave him that job and got me relieved of that chore. But that took place in the recreation hall. They would have classes for this, that, and the other thing with people that were interested in learning something that they didn't know about. And we even had woodwork school over there that they could participate in. There were several different activities that people could get involved in that had a little ambition and wanted to do a little something better for themselves. Yes.
Did many people do this?
No, I wouldn't say too many, because most of them, we didn't have too many dummies. Then on August the 20th, 1936, I took a civil service exam. Mm-hmm. And there's the result. Although I had no schooling in forestry and soil erosion, I managed to score 82. That's the same test that Joe Caliza took. Now, I don't know what his score was. Never did find out. But anyway, I had my job already. I got the job as fire dispatcher before I ever took this test. But a little later on, they decided that I'd better take the test. So after I'd been there for almost a year, they gave me this test, which I scored 82.
You passed it anyway.
Yeah.
Did you or the other guys play any pranks on each other?
Oh, when we got rookies in, we we didn't do anything mean, anything like that, but we would give them a broomstick and tell them to guard the flagpole. And we had them out there, and boy, one old boy took it seriously, too. Some of the fellas came out there and told him that we had pulled a rookie trick on him, and he hit them a few licks with that broom and ran them away. So I know, said, when they tell me to guard the flagpole, I'm going to guard the flagpole, and you're going to stay off of this piece of green like grass right here. I was told to keep everybody off of it. And Buddy, he kept them off, too. Oh, yeah, they'd send somebody up to ECW office, they'd get some poor old dummy sometimes, and they'd send him after a bucket of steam, yeah, and they'd send him after a sky hook, you know, a thing they use in the forest cutting timber and so forth and to carry logs is called a cant hook. But every once in a while, somebody would tell a fellow about getting a sky hook, say, go get a sky hook, if, you know, if it wasn't too bright, he might go ask for it. As a matter of fact, one poor old boy almost got kicked out of camp up there. We had some, that fellow's Fisher was the foreman's name in the timber. And Fisher told him to go get a cant hook. See, he'd already been rookied on that sky hook. And he laughed about it. He told him, said, Mr. Fisher, he says, you can't rookie me. He said, I've been here 3 weeks.
And there really was a cant hook.
Oh, yeah, there is. That's the thing, it's got handles on each end of hooks.
Uh-huh.
It's called a cant hook. I don't know where it got the name cant hook, but nonetheless, he told him, I've been here 3 weeks, you're not rookieing me with a cant hook. They already rookied him on the sky hook. Yeah, they'd pull pranks on him, but not serious, anything like that, mind you. Just minor things.
Did you do anything like short-sheeting beds?
Or? Oh, yeah, we cocked bunks and short-sheeted beds, and sometimes we'd cut a little hair off with GI brush and sprinkle it down in a man's bed, especially on a hot day, on hot nights, and that stuff would just about eat you up. Your GI brush is about this long, sort of oval shaped, and cut the old bristles off of it,
uh-huh.
Put it in his bed. Cocking a bunk now, you see, they fold under at the ends, and you fold it under just right, especially if he's laying out somewhere at night, he comes in, you're not allowed to turn those lights on. And he go over and pile down on that bunk, and whoop, she'd hit the floor. Make wake everybody up. Of course, most people wasn't asleep by then anyway. They was waiting for George or whatever his name happened to be to come in to listen to it. Oh, yeah, they pulled all kinds of... They wasn't bad pranks.
Was there much interaction among the different CCC teams?
Oh, yes. That was what we was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
We had a regular baseball league, 8 teams. Let's see, I believe there was 4 camps there, and there's one at Elizabethtown, one at Hardinsburg, one at Fort Knox, and one at Russellville. At the time, as a matter of fact, two or three years after I left there, I got this letter. Well, this is not the original letter. This is where they decided they had to cancel it because they canceled number 3 camp. This also had to do with that civil service test. You see the date?
Yes.
They had me quit my job. Now, you talk about times were still tough. They had me quit my job, hire a man to take my place, take a physical examination, and then cancel the job because number three camp down at Russellville, I was being sent down there in charge of the soil erosion projects
okay.
that they were doing.
So they tried to
and
get
then
you
they
back.
Canceled it.
They canceled the job.
Yeah. Well, they canceled the camp and that
camp.
Canceled the job. That left me without a job, but I was a lucky dog on my life. And I, at that time, was selling coffee for a coffee company. And about a week later, Standard Coffee advertised in the Park City Daily News for an experienced coffee man. I was the only one in town. So I got that job, and about 3 months later, this has got nothing to do with CCs, about 3 months later, they promoted me over 5 states. Of course, we was about to get into a war, and gasoline was rationed, and I had to travel by bus. But I covered those states until I enlisted in the Air Force in October of 42.
So,
These old keepsakes, you know, I don't know why I keep them.
Well, they're great. They're wonderful. Aside from the athletics, did guys from any of the camps pal around with each other? Or?
Oh, yes. I knew most of the fellows from over at number 2, and that's where Ray Scott was. He was the photographer. And I knew Kaliza and several of the others whose names I can't recall now. And I knew, having played baseball with a lot of them, I knew them from all the camps, all the surrounding camps, even that wasn't at Mammoth Cave. Because I played on 3 different years, although I was only there 2 years, I played on 3 different years teams up there.
how did the whites feel about the presence of a black camp nearby?
We didn't seem to have any trouble at all. We played baseball against them, too. As a matter of fact, I had a big time. There was a little black fellow that played third base, and I played third base and shortstop by that time. And I called him Monkey, and he called me Ellsworth. Ellsworth was the forester's name, although he wasn't Damwich, and he knew that a lot of people, for some reason, don't ask me why, a lot of people didn't like Ellsworth. But he called me Ellsworth Jr. He shortened it to Ellsworth, finally. But we had a lot of fun playing them. We didn't have any trouble with them.
So there really weren't any instances of racial
tension? I don't remember a one. Do not remember a single one. Although they were segregated, they minded their business, and we minded our business. We played basketball against them. We had track meets against them. We had played baseball against them. I don't ever recall one single incident, not one.
What kind of relationship did the CCC have with the people of the surrounding area? You talked a little bit about
it. I talked a little about it. Actually, as far as the people enrolled in the camps were concerned, we didn't have any controversy. As a matter of fact, back over behind number 3 camp, about a mile and a half back over there on Green River, was an old man by the name of Woods, who was a retired school teacher. And I used to go over there a lot of times on Sundays when I didn't have anything else to do. And I would visit the old man because he was highly intelligent. And I was interested in, I always did like to talk to old people because they can tell you a heap of things. And I would go over and visit him. I remember one Sunday, he bet me I couldn't swim Green River with my clothes on. I think he knew I was going to win. But anyway, I did. I took all the stuff out of my pockets and I went down to the river and bang, I went in and I swam over there back with my clothes on. But he thought that was a great piece of sport to get me to do that. And they still had a school nearby. Have you been up there?
I've been up to the park, but I haven't.
You never have been in any of the outlying sections. Well, over just a short distance, 100 yards from number 3 camp, was an old church called Joppa. And they still had church there, and just a short distance from there, where our baseball field was, there was still a lot of people lived in the park area, you know, and they still had school up there. And they would have pie suppers up there at that thing, and Halloween parties, and this, that, and I think most of us fellows, a lot of us would go up there. I remember one time, this old man Woods had a very, very good-looking daughter. Now, she wasn't my girlfriend. She was Pete's girlfriend. I finally called that man's name now, Pete Waggle. Let the picture a minute ago. Anyway, Pete, that was his sweetie pie, and Pete, for some reason or other, couldn't take his girlfriend to the pie supper that night. And it was pouring down rain. There was a mud road that went over there to that place, and so I took my shoes off and carried them in my hand. That's Pete. Remember a while ago I said I couldn't remember his name? Well, that's Pete Waggle. And she was kind of sweetie of his, and for some reason he couldn't go, and he wanted me to go take his girl to the pie supper, which I did. And I took off my shoes and went over there barefooted, and so she just went barefooted with me over to the school and back. Glendon Miller married a girl that lived right over there close to them. Glendon died about a month ago. I'm sorry that he passed on, because he was one of my very, 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 very best friends. And he was in charge of the ECW office there in camp. That's emergency conservation work. He ran the supply room. And we were also co-editors of the Axe and Sledge. I wish I've lost my copies. But once a month, we put out a little company newspaper. Each camp had a paper talking about the activities and this, that, and the other thing. And Glenda and I were the editors of that paper. And I kept a bunch of them, but I can't seem to find them.
So did a lot of the guys date local girls?
Well, yes, they did. I didn't do any dating of local girls myself. Well, there was one that sort of had a crush on me, but she was old man A.A. de Mumbrum, who ran that big store that used to stand right there. You may have heard the name. Her name was Sybil A. Logan. She was the daughter of a United States senator. And she was a telephone operator up there. Oh, I got love letters from her even after I got married. Simple. No, I wasn't fooling around with the girls up there. I had too many things to do.
But a lot of guys did.
Oh, yeah, there were several of them. Johnny Ship married a girl. I don't know how I ever thought that name up there. And Boone Clavinger, that was a nickname. I don't know where he ever got the name Boone. His name was Wayne. He married a girl from over around Brownsville, and then there was one of the cooks married a girl, Pretty. That was her last name. Oh, yeah, there were several of them married girls up there. Another one of the fellows that pitched on the team, well, darn, I can't think of his name, and I can't remember who he married, but he married some girl up there, too. Oh, yeah, I'd say a good number of them.
Did any of the guys ever sneak out of the camp at night for the recording?
Well, if you didn't stay out, you didn't have to sneak out. After work hours, you was allowed to go. But you better be back by reveille, and you better be back there by the time I call that roll, especially if you was on the fire department. Let's see, I think I've got part of that. I don't have it all, but here is a portion of the roster of the fire patrol. Hmm. Most of them were stationed in number 3 camp. Not all of them, but most of them were. And they had better be there when they call roll, or they was going to get into trouble.
So they could go out as long as they got back in time for work.
Yeah, oh yeah. They wasn't restricted about going out. They had freedom. They couldn't go off and stay.
So even though the local residents pretty much accepted the men in
the camp, they just had in for the government. They didn't like the Rangers. As a matter of fact, they shot one of them. I can't remember whether it was Ridge or Wells, and nearly killed him. And we'll get in a minute to where they almost got me killed.
You happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong
time? No, I accepted assignment from them, which I didn't have to take at all. I've thought about it a lot of times since. But I was the fellow that obtained the... Well, I would do it again. Because, you see, those moonshiners didn't have any business making the moonshine. Number 2, they didn't have any business selling it to the CCC boys either. I didn't drink. Didn't think anybody should. Oh, I've had a few cents, but... I didn't think highly of it. And Ridge and Wells came to me and wanted to know if I would help them obtain the evidence. Of course, you know they can't. And they didn't know anybody else that they could trust besides me and Uni Skipworth. That's Uni, I said he was so ornery. He got the phone with a married woman up and damn near got himself killed. Eh? But anyway, they wanted us to... Well, you have to give at least a quart of moonshine whiskey as evidence. Now, there were some tough customers lived up there. So Union and I'd go out, and I'd play drunk. Oh, I can act any role. I'd get a little whiskey on my breath. I'd go staggering down the road, and Union's trying to take care of me, and we'd stagger up to one of these houses. We knew they were selling moonshine. I'd tell them it was my birthday, and I ain't half drunk enough. They'd sell it to anybody. But I wasn't drunk at all. We'd get the evidence, take it and give it to the Rangers, who was parked about a mile away. Then we'd go to Bowling Green to Marshal Funk and swear out a warrant. So they found out who was doing it. They caught Union Cave City one night and damn near killed him. I never did get Union to go with me to get any more evidence for some reason. I can't imagine why. But they finally, they'd come over there. I don't know who it was, but I had to work a lot of times at night at the central office all night. Especially during bad fire season. And they'd come over and prowl around, some of these people, I don't know just who, but we helped them get about a dozen different ones. And they had them for Uni and I pretty good then. Not generally, not the general public, but just the moonshiners that we got caught. So one of the Rangers finally set a shotgun in there. Said, well, don't shoot anybody, but said, when you get to hearing them prowling around, which was about every night, when some of us would be working over there, because they didn't know, actually, they just knew Thomas and Skipworth was dispatchers, but they was 4 others, and they didn't know which ones was on duty, because they didn't know really one of us from the other, and I don't guess. So some of them where we bought the whiskey might have, but I don't think they were the fellow was doing it. I think that would be somewhere they sent to do it. You see, they wasn't fixing to do it themselves. But one night I did poke that shotgun out and let go up in the air, and you know, I never did have much trouble after that, hearing people creeping around. you know where the old train sits?
Yes.
Well, just to the right of that as you go in, down there in a level spot, was where the central office stood, where the fire dispatcher's office was at that time. And, of course, there wasn't many of those other buildings around there. Back over further, there was an old hotel. Big, big, big old hotel stood over there. So it was sort of by itself over here where the central office was. But it wasn't unusual for us to hear some people prowling around out there. But again, I defend those people some because I know how they felt about, especially the condemnation suits. Do you have a question there concerning Ray Scott and the condemnation suits at all?
No, I don't.
Well, let me give you a little pointer here.
Okay.
Even though the park system was paying all every bit of what the land was worth, they still, you can understand, they didn't want to go. They had been there all their lives, and their grandfathers too. So it wasn't a matter of what to get paid. But the park system, the national condemnation suits, the federal condemnation suits, were really not just bum fare. Although, like I said, they was paying what the property was worth. Ray Scott had a considerable amount. You asked me earlier, did people get special assignments? Yes, Ray had been fooling with photography most of his life. I don't have a picture of Ray here. But we became very fast friends, although he was a number three, a number two, and I was a number three. We knew each other well, because we painted signs and so forth. But he didn't have a vehicle assigned to his office, and this was one of the touch-and-go jobs that I did. I would haul Ray to take the pictures. And, of course, Ray was instructed to make the worst picture of the house he could find, and the barns. And we'd go slipping around through the woods, and he had a big old box camera back in those days. That thing was that big and weighed a ton, and a big old tripod that it sit on. I carried that thing, and he carried the camera. We'd park our truck away up in the woods as far as we could get it, and then we'd slip down behind the house, take the worst looking picture we could find. That's where we got run off two or three times with a shotgun. I can see us now flying through the woods. He carrying that great big box of me and Trace and running through the woods and bumping limbs every which way with that tripod over my shoulder. But we nearly got it two or three times. We got shot at a couple of times. Well, I don't think they intended to hit us, but they just intended to scare the daylights out of us, which they did.
Were there any other incidents besides the fires and the moonshiners? Problems between the local residents and, say, the government in general?
Well, like I said, they did a lot of fire sitting deliberately. And when they burned plant beds, see, a lot of them still lived in the area. They would deliberately let their fire get out. They didn't always set it. Now, we had one fella, and I don't think they ever did catch that fella, and I didn't know who was doing it either. But I became very fast friends with his nephew many years later. But over in front of number three camp was a long, long valley called Smith Valley. And this fella, I can't call names on this thing. He's dead now, but his kinfolks are still living. And he had a little old mule. And he'd take a long wire, and he'd tie a grass sack on the back of that thing and soak it with coal oil. And just as regular as all the sage grass got up high, and that stuff burns like mad. And he'd ride all the way down that valley a mile long, dragging that burning rag, deliberately set fires, yeah. And they never did catch that fire. You gotta catch them in the act, you know. They don't be able to prove that he did it. Nobody can prove that he did it. But he was mean about it. Over on the north side of the river, now we had a lot of collaborators. I'll tell you a little story. There was some people, I believe their name was Tunk, that lived down at a little place called Arthur. From number three camp, you go towards Brownsville, and it was a little wide place in the road down there with a store and a post office. About a mile up in front of the store was a lookout tower known as Brooks Knob. And one night, one of the fire towers north of the river, White Oak, called and gave me a reading on a fire. Well, you pull this string up out of the board, you pull it out here, and you look at this azimuth, and you stretch the string, and you stick it in the board. So almost immediately when I hung up, I got another call, and he gave me reading on a fire, and I pulls it across to get the board, and they cross right exactly on Brooks Knob lookout tower. Well, we had, as I say, collaborators. We called them collaborators. So I thought, holy mackerel! I tried to call Brooks Knob, and couldn't give me an answer. But those two strings absolutely crossed right on top of it.
Someone set the tower on.
So I'll get to it, doll.
Okay.
So I called down at this little post office. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. A woman finally answered the phone. I believe her name was Tunk. I said, "Miss Tunk, would you please run out front and look up at Brooks Knob and tell me whether the lookout tower or whether there's a big fire on top of the hill or what's going on up there?" Well, she wasn't gone but a second, and she came dashing back in, all out of breath. She says, "My God," she says, "the tower itself's burning down." The wooden towers, those early ones, was. What happened? It was awful cold. And each tower had a little cabin at the bottom.
And this old boy had gone out. They had a coal oil stove in each one of them. They didn't have a bed in there because he wasn't supposed to go to bed, but they'd let him come down and get warm. And then he'd go back up and report every hour, not on the hour, but every hour, a certain time. He had decided to put him a bunch of that old dead sage grass and bring in there to make him a bed to lay down on. And somehow or another, during the night, he had kicked the stove over, and it liked to got him, too. And it went the whole damn lookout tower. I thought that was one of the funniest things. And here I'm over at the central office, and I'm trying to call that tower. I've got an intersection here right on top of it, and I can't get any answer.
No wonder you couldn't get any answer.
We had several people who were, you know, broader-minded and more open-minded that were on the side of the park and helped us every way that they could. But I would say the majority of them was rather hostile. Was rather hostile, yeah. But they had reasons.
Well, how successful do you feel like the CCC was in relieving the effects of the Depression?
I wish that I had. I can't seem to find that last CCC journal. See, there's a nationwide organization now, and they have reunions every year. And they put out this thing, and it tells all the multitude of things that they did accomplish and what they did. But may I say this to you? One of the greatest things they did, they trained a bunch of men who became the finest troops the world has ever seen in World War II. Their background in that, and they write about it a lot. Many of them had already, not necessarily military training, but they had had enough that they were not strangers to it, and they didn't necessarily object to the strenuousness of military training and so forth and so on, and there has been literally volumes written about what a great asset it was, and I'm just wondering if Franklin D. Roosevelt couldn't look ahead maybe and see that coming on. But that is one of the greatest things that possibly they did. As to the relief, it was the finest thing in my opinion, and they are trying to get it reinstigated. That's one of the reasons for the national organization, and it is before Congress, and it is being considered seriously to start such an organization again for young men who need something to do and to train them for occupations and so forth and so on. And they certainly could use them, because the men earned their money. It was not a gift. There was nothing charitable about it. If you don't think they earned that $30, boys, just interview a few. They earned every dollar. I have been working on the farm for 50 cents a day all the time I was going to school. And when I lived in town, of course, that time I lived in the country when it got so bad. But before that, I had caddied, carried newspapers, worked at a barbecue stand. I did it all.
What about for the residents around Mammoth Cave? Do you think it helped the CCC being in the area, helped their economy at all?
Oh yes, without question. Without question, you can see that, can't you? Look at the motels. Look at the little concessions they got all over the country up there. Oh yes, during tourist season, it probably brings in millions and millions of dollars to the surrounding area. You see, Mammoth Cave is, I suppose, supposed to be one of the seven wonders of the world. It never was that great of an attraction to me. That was another thing that you might be interested in knowing. There was a time that they considered air conditioning the hotel. You see, a cave, the temperature varies 52 to 54. Now, in addition to running the fire department, all the firefighting equipment, we also had a weather station there at the central office. We gauged the rainfall, the snowfall. We took the temperature readings three times a day. We took the psychrometer, that measures humidity, three times a day. And for about 6 months, we had to go into the cave, back into what they call the dining room, and take a psychrometer reading there three times a day to test the humidity. They decided that it was a little too humid to air conditioning the hotel with, but nonetheless they did consider it. One time before that, some doctor got that. You need to change that.
Yeah, I think I better go ahead and change the
tape.
Save the story. This is the second tape of my interview with Mr. O.L. Thomas on his work with the CCC, June 8, 1987.
Gave itself and was taking psychrometer readings. I think it perhaps might have been in the late 1890s or somewhere along in there, or early 1900. Some doctor got the idea that to build a sanitarium there at the in the Mammoth Cave would be good for tuberculosis. It didn't work that way. As a matter of fact, it was bad for it. So that didn't last long. It was just a little sidelight. I didn't know whether you might know about about the cave or not. But anyway, we had to, because of the thoughts about the air conditioning. Once in a while, now you was asking about some of the camp life, once in a while a storm or something would knock out the pumps and the water supply, and we would be rationed on water. And in order to take baths, we'd have to go down to did you go down to Ferry?
Absolutely.
The ferry's not located exactly where it was. It was up the river about a half mile in the old days. And it was all the way across there was kind of a shallow place, about, I'd say 4 feet deep. And they would be 1,000 men down there taking baths in that thing at the same time. I remember lots of weekends when the water was shut off due to a storm or something, and we had some mean ones too. Well, we'd all have to go down the river to take a bath. And by the way, if we got a fella in that was scared of water, you know, and he didn't take a bath often enough, they'd take him to the latrine, and they'd throw him in the shower. And he'd get in there with a GI brush and scrub him, and he didn't have to have that done but about once, and he'd go take a bath when he needed it. But all in all, the boys didn't have any trouble to speak of. Oh, now and then they would be a little rucous, but nothing. It didn't amount to anything.
We already talked about the biggest successes of the CCC. What do you consider to be the biggest problem that they might have had? Or,
you know, I don't recall any major problem. They were well accepted, I thought, all over the country as far as I was concerned. I think that it was smiled upon because it was a fine project, and the work that they did was well known by practically all of the citizenry. The only courthouse I can think of right now, they built a number of courthouses, and of course that was just in this area. Out west they did a lot of things that we didn't do here, and in the east they did some things. But now they built, have you ever been to Cumberland Falls?
No, I haven't.
That original lodge was built by the Civilian Conservation Corps, and that stone bridge across Cumberland River down there just above the falls was built by them. Excellent work. Of course, they had overseers. But many men, let me give you an example of one. Very, very few of the people that was in those camps were illiterate. However, I had a friend who enrolled in those camps not long after I did. And his sweetheart had graduated from high school. His father had been in the logging business. His name was Cox. I don't think of his first name in a minute. But anyway, he couldn't even read and write. And I knew the girl he was going with and all that sort of stuff here in Bowling Green. She'd write him letters, and I'd read the letters to him. Now, this is not to say the man was ignorant. I mean, stupid. He was ignorant. He had never had the opportunity. His daddy wouldn't let him go to school. And neither one of his brothers had ever attended school. But I'd read the letters to Cox. And then he'd want me to write her a letter. And I'd say, what do you want me to say? He said, just say what you'd say. I must have said the right things because he married her. And then he took a discharge from camp. She managed to get him a job somewhere in the construction business, and he learned it well. Not only that, but I taught him to read and write before he ever left up there, and he was sharp. It didn't take him any time to learn to read and write. You remember I told you that I also had a hand in the educational department over there. Here I am, a high school graduate, and I'm doing all this stuff too. Well, anyway, I was a little sharp, if I do say so. But I taught him to read and write, and they got married. And she got him a job with someone she knew that was in the construction business, and he became a millionaire. The last time I saw him, which has been several years ago now, he was driving big long Cadillacs and throwing money around. He went to Louisville and started his own construction company. I think that was one of my highlights. I think I'm about as proud of that as most anything I've ever done.
Yeah.
I feel that I rendered a service to my fellow man. I guess I'm a little conscientious about things like that. You know, I sit in there, that's the reason my eyes are so red. I stay up till 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm busy right in there now answering a bunch of letters and some requests for ancestors and so forth. But I think everybody ought to do something. I also write a church bulletin. The pen is mightier than the sword. I've been mowing that churchyard up there now for about 3 years. So I wrote an editorial the other day in that church paper. And you know what? Last Thursday, there were 6 fellas showed up there and mowed the yard for me. I didn't know it would be that effective.
You're right, though.
So last night, they was horsing me about that editorial, and I said, you know, this pen is mightier than the sword.
So after your 2 years in the CCC, what did you do?
Well, I came out and took a job doing this, that, and the other thing. I was working for the Pet Milk Company. They had a very large plant here.
Which company?
Pet Milk Company had a very large plant here. So I took a job working down there, which was slavery. But I had always fancied that I wanted to be in the selling business. But I had no experience. I had the experience, but they didn't know it. You couldn't prove it. But finally some fool came along and gave me a job in the coffee business. And I more than tripled their business the first month I was with them. And that's the job that this letter right here caused me to quit and hire a man to take my place. And then they discontinued the camp down there.
So then you got a job.
And they were very sorry about all of that, but that didn't help my financial condition any. But about a month later, Standard Coffee Company was looking for an experienced coffee salesman, and I was the only one in town, so I didn't have any trouble getting that job. Oh, by the way, to get this first coffee selling job that I had to post a $250 bond. Everything I owned in the world wouldn't have, at that time, amounted to $250. I must have sold the fellow pretty good. Well, he came to give me the job, and I told him, I said, I can't take it because I can't raise the money. But about a week later, he came back and he says, can you raise $50? He says, we're determined to give you that job if you can find any way at all to post $50, and we'll take the rest out of your pay. I said, I don't have $50. I said, I've never borrowed any money in my life. But I said, I'm going to try. So I went up to the Citizens National Bank and introduced myself to the fellow, to the banker. I says, now the man's over at the hotel that's wanting to give me the job. You may call him and talk with him. He did. He gave me the $50. And I was got started in the selling business. And I've been in it ever since.
Except you also were in the Air Force during World War II?
I spent 3.5 years in the Air Force. But let me tell you a little about my selling experience in the insurance business. After I got out of the Air Force in 45, I went in the insurance business. And the highest echelon you could achieve in the life insurance business is known as the $1 Million Round Table. And for 30 years, I was the only MDRT between Louisville and Nashville. One of the companies that I represented started what they call the Continental Club. See, you could choose a Cadillac or a Continental if you were their company leader. They did that 10 years and I won 6 of the 10. I got into the estate planning end of it. See, there's a lot of tax advantage in some life insurance. I'm not trying to sell something here because I'm retired now. But anyway, I got to doing a lot of business with the big farmers around all over the country. Some of them as much as 6,000 acres of land. You see, inheritance tax was a monster. I've known of a few cases where they sold everything the people had and it just paid the interest on the tax due. So I cut all those clippings out of papers. I'd show them these people, scare the daylights out of them. What can I do? Well, I'd show them a tax book. Boy, you'd be surprised at the attorneys and accountants that I've crammed back in holes, because they fight you. You see, the biggest mess of anybody's estate's in, when they pass to the great beyond, the more money the attorney and the accountant gets out of it. And the better prepared he is, the less they get out of it. It hadn't been too long, too many years ago, when one of the leading accountants here in town told an automobile dealer that I didn't know what I was talking about. I said, you call him, make an appointment with him now. Because I said, he's going to retract that. We went over and he says, my tax book don't say that. And I laid it out on mine on his desk and I said, yours is just like mine. I said, now you tell this fella straight. When he looked at my tax book, and he said, I don't remember seeing that. And I said, well, you're supposed to be a CPA. I said, you better dig your book out here. Well, he was all apology. He got his book out and it had the same paragraph in it mine had. And he had told him I didn't know what I was talking about. People don't challenge O.L. Thomas.
I'm a fighter. If you haven't been able to tell it by the past, then you're pretty dumb.
I can tell.
Nobody challenges me. Nobody tells me that there's something I can't do. Because if it can be done and somebody has done it, I think I can. And I might just improve it a little bit. Yeah, I went out when I was in the Air Force for a baseball team that had four major leaguers on it. And everybody laughed at me. They said, well, you can't make that team. I did. Then I was made an instructor over at Scott Field, just out of St. Louis. And I spent all of my time over at Sportsman's Park. I only had to be on the field 4 hours a day, and the rest of it I took infield practice, stayed in the dugouts with the Cardinals. I knew every major leaguer in both major leagues in those days. I would send all those signatures home and all those autographs and all that sort of stuff to the various different people that I knew that loved that kind of stuff.
Well,
so much for all that crap.
Do you have anything else you'd like to tell me about the CCC?
Do you have any more questions?
Finish with my questions.
Well, I can't think of anything else of any... I could tell you one story, but I better not on this tape. I told it to what's his name?
Bob.
You know the one I'm talking about?
No, I didn't hear the story, but he was going to let me listen to the tape, but I haven't had a chance yet.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you'll turn it off, we'll tell you the story.
Okay, thanks.
Because I don't want...